And welcome to the Deep Dive Radio Show. As always, I'm your host, Nick Espinoza, and we're going to be talking about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related. And I think we're one of the only ones out there that's doing that right now. If you'd like to be part of the radio show in any way, shape, or form, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can send us an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. We have an action-packed show as always. There's always a lot to cover, so stick around with us as we deep dive into a topic and we catch up on everything else. So without further ado, let's begin.
And we've got a great hour for you. Obviously, we're going to be catching up on some really interesting news. The breaches of the week has just been absolutely nuts, as always. But our deep dive is actually going to be on the entire Freedom Convoy, those truckers up in Canada that are blocking everything. Because while in many ways, as people are looking at whatever news outlet they're looking at, it looks like it's just this grassroots movement, but there's a lot more going on. There's a lot more foreign influence than you may think. So we're going to be diving into that. I've actually done my homework for that for an upcoming article. So you guys are going to get a sneak preview of that here in the deep dive segment, but I am very afraid this is going to spill over into the United States. And so there you go. So with that, let's get going. It's going to be a great hour. And as always, we'll start with the news. And in CIA news, I'm asking the question, has the CIA been secretly collecting data on Americans? And this is coming from Bloomberg, and I think this is important. I'll probably do a deep dive on this entire history. But here's what's going on. This is, like I said, recent news. Senators Ron Wyden of Oregon and Martin Heinrich of New Mexico have expressed alarm in an April 13th letter of last year to Avril Haines, the director of the National Intelligence, and William Burns, the director of CIA. Now, the agency said basically that their surveillance programs here involved, and I quote, counterterrorism intelligence-related activities that operated under Presidential Executive Order 12333. It also announced, and again, this happened in the last week, even though that letter was sent back in April, it also announced that portions of the reports on the programs were being declassified, according to a statement this past Thursday. Now, the senators, members of the Intelligence Committee, say that the agency has, quote, conducted its own bulk program and has done so outside the statutory framework that Congress and the public believe govern this collection. The letter, which was heavily redacted, did not indicate how long exactly the surveillance had unfolded, how widespread it had been, or what sort of information was collected and from whom. Senators Wyden and Heinrich, who had asked about the amount of data collected and the circumstances of its storage and dissemination, said the program or programs didn't have the oversight safeguards of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, which governs the tracking of people suspected of being involved in terrorism or espionage. Until a report was delivered last March, the senators said, quote, the nature and full extent of the CIA's collection was withheld even from the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. The White House did not immediately respond to requests for comments basically made by Bloomberg, the request made by Bloomberg that Thursday night, so like a week ago or so. In a two-page statement on that Thursday, the CIA said it keeps the intelligence panel up to speed on its programs and, quote, all CIA officers have a solemn obligation to protect the privacy and civil liberties of Americans. Declassified reviews covered the years from 2015 to 2021, according to the CIA. And I quote again, the CIA recognizes and takes very seriously our obligation to respect the privacy and civil liberties of every U.S. person in the conduct of our vital national security mission and conducts our activities, including collection activities, in compliance with U.S. law, Executive Order 12333, and our Attorney General's guidelines. That is according to Christy Scott, the CIA's privacy and civil liberties officer, in an email statement to Bloomberg, and I quote again, the CIA is committed to transparency consistent with our obligations to protect intelligence sources and methods. And this is actually really interesting because, aside from the fact that, holy cow, the CIA could be gathering bulk data on us, this is not the first time we've heard of these kinds of things. Accidentally, a few years ago, the Pentagon or Department of Defense left open an Amazon S3 bucket, basically a data storage, that exposed that they had been scraping and collecting billions of records from social media on basically everybody. Essentially, everybody's scraping Facebook, so why doesn't the government do it too? So it's not surprising that the CIA would do this, despite the fact that their mission takes them outside of the U.S. borders. Their jurisdiction is outside of the U.S., not inside the U.S., but if they have suspected terrorists that they are looking for, here we are. Like I said, I could do a deep dive on this one as well, you know, completely, because we also have these geolocation warrants that essentially Google says, yeah, well, here's absolutely everybody in a 2-mile radius that the warrant states, and therefore you can look at absolutely everything in that 2-mile radius. And that means that, let's say there's a potential, I don't know, murderer or terrorist or something that lives within 2 miles of me. Now they've got my motion and movements and my data as well, because, again, it's a blanket warrant. Now you combine this with things like intelligence agencies surveilling their own citizens, and that is properly scary. And so we'll see where this goes. We'll see what happens. But that is your CIA news of the week. And in digital currency news, not cryptocurrency, but digital currency news, we're talking about the U.S. and its possible adoption of a digital currency. Now, this is coming from NPR, and I found this to be just absolutely interesting, because here's what's going on. The U.S. is considering whether to adopt a digital version of its currency, one better suited for today's increasingly cashless world, ushering in what could be one of the dollar's most fundamental transformations. In that scenario, the United States would not only mint the coins and paper bills that we all use, but it would also issue digital cash, or a central bank digital currency known as CBDC. That would be stored in apps or digital wallets on our smartphones, very similar to how cryptocurrency works. We then could use that to pay for things just like we could Venmo or Apple Pay or, you know, any one of those things that a ton of people use, and no physical money would actually change hands. It's a vision of a cashless future that other countries are already embracing. China, for example, has unveiled the digital yuan on a trial basis, the yuan obviously being their currency. India also last week said that it would create a digital rupee obviously being their currency. Now, the U.S. is weighing whether it wants to get into this game. And last month, basically in January, the Federal Reserve released a much anticipated paper laying out the advantages and disadvantages of a digital currency. The Fed says that it's a first step meant to kickstart an important conversation among policymakers and to gather feedback from average people to some of the country's largest financial institutions. Basically, they want to hear from everybody, which essentially is what the government is supposed to do in terms of its transparency. But here's what we know about the digital dollar, and the NPR laid this out. I've been almost quoting them verbatim through this entire thing. So the first question that they asked was, how would this actually work? And so this is what we know so far. The transactions conducted with digital dollars probably wouldn't seem too different from existing private alternatives that allow us to pay for things, basically bringing our smartphones next to digital readers. So if you have your credit card linked to like Apple Pay or Google Pay or Samsung Pay or any one of the pays, you know, you can tap your phone, it'll connect, it'll sync, it'll transfer the data, and then there you go. You're using like, it's like a credit card. So the question then becomes, why pursue a digital currency? And the answer to that NPR came up with is reducing or eliminating fees is obviously a clear benefit. When you make a contactless payment today, it may seem immediate, but according to Chris Giancarlo, the former chairman of the Commodities Future Trading Commission, a lot actually happens behind the scenes. And to quote Mr. Giancarlo, my mobile device tells his mobile device to inform a whole series of banks to confirm who I am, how much money is in my bank, that there is enough money to move from my bank to his bank, etc. Now, at each step of the way, there are transaction fees. And in 2020, those fees added up to more than $110 billion US every time we decided to move money to pay for something, etc., etc. And those were generally shouldered by businesses across the nation. But with the digital dollar, you could, in theory, eliminate a lot of those middlemen. If you wanted to buy a sandwich, for example, you could transfer money from a digital wallet directly to a cashier in the same way that you could take like physical currency out of your wallet and hand it to the cashier. And obviously, you probably get change back, etc. But it would work the same way. It wouldn't necessarily eliminate entirely non-government players, though. In China, for example, users who want to use a digital yuan can go to banks to add money to their digital wallets. But just having digital dollars in circulation could put pressure on credit card companies and payment processors to lower their fees to be more competitive. That is, if enough people start using the Fed-run version, we may see a dramatic paradigm shift in all of those transaction fees that literally they're making over $110 billion a year on. And so the next question obviously then becomes, What are the challenges here? And without a question, one of the biggest issues is privacy. And I, of course, you're sitting here listening to me on the deep dive, so you know I'm all about cybersecurity and privacy. But because the Fed would implement and oversee the project, the central bank could accrue a vast amount of data, potentially giving it a lot more visibility into your financial life. That obviously could be useful for regulators who want to do things like combat money laundering, but it also raises concerns about privacy. Cybersecurity obviously is another critical issue, especially given just the increase in hacks and heists of cryptocurrency exchanges. Oftentimes they find vulnerabilities, they get in, they steal. I mean, I've talked about this ad nauseum here and on my daily podcast and video and all that kind of stuff. So obviously cybersecurity is a huge, huge part of this. But to implement a digital dollar, the U.S. government would need to modernize the country's financial infrastructure to stave off these kinds of attacks. And quite frankly, that's a massive lift. And so as we are looking at this, I think that we are probably years out from an actual digital currency. And the reason why I say that is because essentially the wheels of Congress grind slowly. For those things to be adopted, there would probably have to be a vote in Congress. We can't get, it seems like, both sides of the aisle to really agree on anything major. There's a ton of bills that are passed almost unanimously. A lot of people don't realize that, but with something this big and potentially controversial, you're going to see camps starting to form of those that are for it, those that are against it, and those that are, I don't know, up for vote swings, I guess. So there you go. It's going to be an interesting time. We're going to see what happens, but I predict we'll get a digital currency here. It's probably not going to be the next couple of years, and upgrading our massive financial institutions for better cyber hygiene, again, is going to take an army of cybersecurity nerds like me to get that done. So there you go. That is your interesting / U.S. digital currency news of the week. And in virtual terrorism news, and yes, I am talking about virtual terrorism, because apparently virtual terrorism, I'll say it again for the third time there, is apparently a real thing. Now, here's what's going on. This is coming from the Euronews and AFP news sources. A Russian teenager has been sentenced to 5 years in prison for allegedly planning to blow up a virtual building of the FSB security service created in the computer game Minecraft. Now, the person we're talking about here is Nikita Uvarov. He's age 16, and he was sentenced to 5 years in prison by a Siberian military court for, and I quote, training for terrorist activities. And that is according to rights lawyer Pavel Chikov talking to the Telegram. Now, two other defendants were cleared of criminal charges and handed suspended sentences because they cooperated with investigators, according to Chikov. The hearing was held behind closed doors. Now, Uvarov and two other teenagers in the Siberian city of Kansk were detained in the summer of 2020 for spreading leaflets in support of a Moscow mathematician who also happens to be an anarchist activist who was on trial for vandalism in Moscow. The trio basically put out these leaflets on a local building of the FSB. If you didn't know, the FSB is basically Russia's powerful domestic security agency that was the successor to the Soviet era KGB. Well, basically, they're plastering these leaflets on essentially what is the KGB 2.0 building. Probably not the best thing you can do in Vladimir Putin's Russia. Now, police confiscated their phones, and they said that they found an exchange about plans to blow up an FSB building that they created in the popular block building game Minecraft. Now, according to investigators, the trio was also learning to make improvised explosive devices, or IEDs, and practice detonating them in abandoned buildings. So that would obviously be in real life. Now, the teenagers initially faced more severe charges of, quote, participating in a terrorist organization, but the case was dropped due to lack of evidence. And in his words in court, as reported by the local newspaper, Uvarov spoke about the pressure from authorities during the investigation and denied planning to actually blow anything up. He pleaded not guilty and said that if he is handed real prison time, he will serve it, and I quote, with a clear conscience and dignity. For the last time in this court, I want to say I am not a terrorist. Now, this is not the first time in recent years that young Russians have received prison sentences for controversial and preemptive terrorist charges, but I think it really opens up an interesting question that society probably has to debate. What is a good use of, let's say, the internet for things like cathartic release? there are going to be people that, let's say, would plan and design and carry out and coordinate things online. So, for example, if Minecraft, and I think really honestly, this comes down to the intent of Nikita Uvarov and his two compatriots, it really comes down to their intent. So if you are an actual terrorist organization, you might want to leverage something like Minecraft to essentially build up a potential schematic of the building that you're planning to attack so that you can say, okay, strategically, this is where we're going to put all of our charges, like all that kind of stuff. Or maybe you're just not a fan of the government, and so you build one in Minecraft and you're just blowing off steam by blowing up the building. There's no intent there. There's no translation into, yes, I'm actually going to go do this. Now, if the police are not lying and they actually were blowing up improvised explosive devices in a building, like an abandoned building as practice, then it is very possible that, you know, they were planning something above and beyond just going, you know, through Minecraft. So I think it's a very interesting case. I think it's a potentially contentious case, but I think it'd be a rather interesting discussion to have on virtual terrorism, because virtual terrorism apparently is a thing and it is punishable at least by prison time in Russia. So we'll see where that goes around the world. Obviously, we have no legal precedent here from Russian law, but I think it's a rather interesting case that prosecutors globally are going to look at and say, oh, that kid was basically building something in Minecraft, you know, wherever, and blew it up. And he's basically publicly saying that he despises, you know, ex-government or ex-system or ex-something. Now they can make a causal link in some way, shape, or form and get prosecution. So I think it's going to be interesting to see. I'll keep you up to date if I hear anything else, but virtual terrorism is apparently a very real thing. And before we head over to the next segment, I wanted to let you know, and I've done this in a couple of shows, and I keep being reminded to do this, and I always forget. If you didn't know, I put out content on a daily basis, not just here on the radio where you're listening to me, but actually I put it quite a lot of places, daily podcasts and videos on some of the latest trends, technology, cybersecurity, privacy, all these kinds of things I keep day to day. And some of the segments that I do for my news section or even my breaches of the week every Sunday gets translated into the show. But I do this as essentially a labor of love. You know, I don't have any kind of monetization anywhere. I just do it to keep people informed and to keep everybody interested. But you can find me basically on Twitter or Facebook at @NickAESP or on LinkedIn and YouTube at @NickEspinoza. And please follow me. I'd love to basically get a shout out from you and you know, send me a message or whatever it is. But I do content daily and I hope you guys enjoy it. And so that is my quick blurb.
You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And now for Breaches of the Week. And if you have a data breach to report that's local to you or the major news might have missed it, please, by all means, send it to me, and I'm glad to give you a shout out and include it in the radio show and possibly a daily video. And you can find me on Twitter and Facebook at @NickAESP. Again, that's @NickAESP. Or you can email questions at securityfanatics.com. Again, that's questions at securityfanatics.com. And I'm more than happy to include your data breach and give you a shout out on the air. With that, let's begin.
And this week in data breaches is absolutely nuts. We have had just a lot of spectacular data breaches. And as always, I'd like to thank the following people, you know, that sent me this information. Chris Fallon, Jason Dance, Richard Reefer, Barrett Peterson, and Jacqueline Wolf. Thank you so unbelievably much. Let's dive right in because I don't want to waste time. And let's start with Olone Community College District in the state of California here in the U.S., and since January 20th, the district says it has, quote, experienced a network disruption that does not allow access to certain files on its network. In other words, it looks like they got hit, they got compromised, and data from former students and staff, as well as current ones, is caught up in this. Now, this includes a ton of personal information that is likely names, dates of birth, student ID numbers, social security numbers, U.S. alien registration numbers, because it's college, race and ethnicity, driver's license numbers, financial account numbers, routing numbers, financial institution names, medical information, health insurance information, class lists, course schedules, grades, transcripts, disciplinary files, and the kitchen sink. So if you have anything to do whatsoever with Olone Community College in California, you definitely want to check in there. Moving on.
Let's talk about Advent Health Partners, because they've been investigating a security issue after finding suspicious activity on employee email accounts, and they issued a notice in September of 2021 to all of their affected customers, which means we are about to see a whole bunch of health systems start to declare that we're using Advent as a vendor. The first one this past week was Herman Health System in Houston, Texas, claiming 6,260 of their patients were affected. We will see more. But heads up, Herman Health System patients in Houston, Texas, or around, I assume, Houston, Texas. There you go. Moving on. Let's talk about the Morley companies in the state of Michigan, because on February 21st, they began to send notice of data security incident letters to current and former employees, as well as their clients. In total, the data of 521,046 individuals was compromised in this breach. I don't have more specifics than that, other than the fact it was a ransomware attack on August 1st of 2021. And now we are learning about this now. So if you have anything to do with the Morley companies out of the state of Michigan, heads up. Moving on, let's talk about the Parasol Umbrella Company. I've heard of them, interestingly enough. They had a cyber attack on their systems about 5 weeks ago, and this has just come to light. It is a suspected ransomware attack, and I don't have much more information at this time, as I found basically one site really talking about this in terms of news, and that site had a paywall, and I'm not paying for one article. There you go. Don't call me cheap, just call me educated. Moving on. Let's talk about voting software company EasyVote Solution. That's the last thing we ever want to hear, is a voting company having problems. But here's what's happening. They said this past Tuesday that they experienced a data breach on January 31 of this year, resulting in some Georgia voters' registration information being shared on the internet. That is according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, major publication out of Atlanta. Now, no social security numbers or driver's license numbers were shared online, according to EasyVote's CFO, Charles Davis. However, public information such as names, addresses, races, and birth dates were shared in an online forum. EasyVote offers basically services to simplify the check-in process for voters in many Georgia counties, including Fulton, Oconee, which I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly, or Oconee, and Paulding. I believe Fulton is one of the larger ones around Atlanta, but Georgians, you can correct me on that. Now, the software is not connected to the official voter registration system in Georgia, and therefore it is not really affecting voters as they're voting. And basically, it's not used in election results or to count ballots. So this will have no effect on the election. You cannot look at this and say, aha, they were hacked and therefore votes were changed and somebody else really won, that kind of thing. We are not having that in this breaches of the week. No voters were affected in that manner because no ballots are counted on that system. It purely is a check-in system for voting. I just want to stress that because I don't want this used as evidence by somebody when it shouldn't be. Moving on. Let's talk about Vodafone Portugal. Vodafone being obviously the massive German mobile cellular company. This is their Portuguese division, and their Portuguese unit did say this past Tuesday that an attacker attacked them overnight and disrupted their service, but they assured their customers in Portugal that their data has not been compromised as a result of this incident, which they are still investigating. Vodafone Portugal said in a statement basically that its systems faced technical problems this past Monday evening, about a week ago or so. There you go, with thousands of customers reporting that they were unable to make calls or access the internet on their phones or computers. They later discovered the technical issues were caused by what they described as a deliberate and malicious cyber attack. And I quote, "There is no evidence customer data has been accessed or compromised. An in-depth investigation of the criminal act will continue for an indefinite period with the involvement of the competent authorities," as opposed to, I guess, the incompetent authorities, which you never want to work with anyway. So make sure that when you have a data breach, you're contacting the competent authorities. I think that's probably something lost in translation from Portuguese to English, but I did find that amusing. Moving on. Speaking of phone carriers, let's talk about Croatian phone carrier A1 Hrvatska, and I believe I am pronouncing that correctly. Croatians, I apologize if I'm not. Up to 10% of A1, I'm just going to call them A1 Hrvatska's customers, which is roughly 200,000 people, could have their personal details compromised due to a security breach. The Croatian cellular operator said, and I quote, "Unfortunately, despite advanced protection measures and the constant raising of the level of security, an incident occurred related to one of the user databases, which compromised part of the personal data of A1 users." So heads up to you, if you use Croatian phone carrier A1 Hrvatska, There you go. And I know I actually have listeners and viewers in Croatia. I occasionally get messages from there. Moving on, let's head on over to Slovenia, basically the home of former First Lady Melania Trump. And we are talking about Pop TV. That is the most popular TV channel, apparently, in the country of Slovenia. A cyber attack disrupted the operations of Pop TV, and the impact in Pop did their of impact in Pop TV's, say that five times, computer network, and prevented the company from showing any computer graphics for the evening edition of 24UR. That is their apparently their daily news show. The night edition basically was canceled altogether, and a truncated version of the news aired on the company's website, according to a statement released on February 8th. That was the day of the attack. The next day, Wednesday the 9th, Pop TV said that the attack also hit some of its web servers, including VOYO or Voyo, which is an on-demand streaming platform that offers channels from its parent company, along with licensed movies and TV series. So if you're in Slovenia and Pop TV wasn't working for you last week, now you know why. Heads up. Moving on. Let's talk about the Foreign Office of the UK, or the UK Foreign Office, because they say that they were hacked in a major cybersecurity incident, forcing it to parachute in additional support with extreme urgency from its cybersecurity contract, BAE Systems Applied Intelligence. Now, the UK government only revealed the existence of the, quote, serious cybersecurity incident affecting the Foreign, Commonwealth, and Development Office through a public tender announcement. Tender, not Tinder. And I don't think the government is using Tinder to announce these kinds of things. Contract information released by the government on February 4th shows that the department was forced to call in urgent support from the security firm to support remediation and investigation of the FCDO. That's the Foreign, Commonwealth, and Development Office. And they initially refused to comment on this when they were approached by publications. The department employs 17,300 staff in diplomatic and developmental offices, including 280 overseas embassies and high commissions. Obviously, this is a very critical branch for the UK government. Hopefully, they'll get back on their feet.
And stay tuned. Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show. As we take a quick break for a public service announcement, we'll be back right after that.